Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is an award-winning journalist, presenter, and one half of the comedy double act Scummy Mummies. Born in South London, in 2001, my guest joined Sony and wrote the manuals for first-party PlayStation games. She moved into journalism, covering games for a variety of publications, including Eurogamer, The Guardian, Metro, and Vice. In 2013, she met aspiring comic Helen Thorne, and together the pair decided to form a double act to celebrate the scummier side of parenting. Since then, they have toured the UK to packed-out venues and launched one of the world's most popular parenting podcasts, examining everything from mental health to politics, wine to sex. My guest has continued to play games, however, appearing as a co-presenter in Dara O'Brien's Go 8-Bit TV series and via streaming marathons on Twitch. Welcome, Ellie Gibson.
Hello! That is a very impressively put together biography. First of all, I thought for a minute you were saying I was born in 2001, which I really enjoyed. Is that just knowledge you've accumulated from all the years I've known you over beers, or is that just you just logged all that information for this moment?
Right, well, yeah, so it was a combination of knowing you as a friend, also Google, and then also I wanted to tell you this. Have you heard of this website, millionsofcelebs.com?
No. What's millionsofcelebs.com? Am I on it?
You are on it.
Exciting.
It's not even like written by an AI or anything. I think it's written by maybe someone for whom English is not their first language, I would say, but it's got loads of Ellie Gibson facts. So do you want to hear some of them? And you can confirm or deny.
Yeah, I'll say true or false.
I won't read out all of them, but some of them are. Ellie Gibson is married to her husband, Peter, with whom she has two sons.
True. True story.
True. Okay. They have been cherishing a soothing married life since their nuptial tie.
False. 100% false. Not today, not ever.
She gives pro tips to her children to know what they should play and how long they should play.
I'm always giving pro tips. I'm always like, right, darling, when you finish brushing your teeth, I've got some pro tips for you. So come into the lounge.
Yeah.
That's right.
Good. What do you advise them to play, by the way?
oh, I've given up really on all that sort of nonsense. They don't listen to me. They don't care. I love that. I'm going to go. Do you know how much the temptation is now? Because I've got a massive ego to just get off this Zoom as quickly as possible and just Google myself.
There's more to come, Ellie, by the way.
Oh, sorry. Go on, Simon.
Just two last ones.
Let's talk about me some more. I'm very much enjoying it.
Okay. Ellie Gibson's actual age is yet to be disclosed.
Well, born in 2001, that would make me, hang on.
Gibson hasn't disclosed her net worth details publicly, but she has been a veteran video game journalist and stand-up comedian for the last few years. Her net worth is estimated in the millions.
Absolutely. That's what I choose to live in, Catford. I could be in Beverly Hills right now. I could be in Dulwich Village. But no, Catford, that's where I live with all my millions of dollars. That's amazing.
I need to go back and edit the intro then a bit, I think. Include some of those facts.
Yeah, no, you need to. Also, I wasn't aware of that website, but I'm also on the excellent website WikiFeet. Have you heard of WikiFeet?
Oh, God. Is it pictures of women's feet?
It's pictures of women's feet. Oh, no. And my feet are on there. Because, like, one time I took a picture of my legs because I've got some Sonic the Hedgehog leggings. So yeah. There's a picture of that. And another time I broke my toe chasing my son down a beach on a school trip. So I sent a picture of it to Dr. Range over the internet. And that's on there. Right. And I've got an ongoing rivalry with my close personal friend TV's Cherry Healy, because she's also on WikiFeet. And we have an ongoing... And our ratings are quite similar. And they tend to like... Yeah, so if anyone listening is
who's in the lead at the moment?
Oh, it's usually Healy, to be honest. She has got very nice feet, and she is actually famous. So she's got those two things going for her, I feel like. She's got an unfair advantage. Also, her feet are nicer. I've got very strange feet. But yeah, it's a way to pass the time, isn't it?
Yeah, right. What's the business model then? Do they sell upgrades if you want to see more feet, or is it just they put ads around the feet?
They just do it for the love of it, Simon. Have you never created something just for the sheer joy of making art?
Oh yeah, of course. My mistake, sorry. Oh man. So I mean, speaking of your feet, you're about to go on a trek. What a link.
I am going to use them very soon. That's right, Simon.
So, tell us about it. On Friday, you're off to Kathmandu, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, so today is Wednesday. Shit, fuck. Are we allowed to swear?
Sure.
Done it now. Shit, fuck. So on Friday, my comedy partner, close personal friend and business associate, Helen Thorne, and I are going to fly to Kathmandu, where together with some other people, we're going to trek to the base of Mount Everest, where we will perform a 30-minute comedy show and hopefully break the record for the highest stand-up comedy gig on land. I have to say on land because, annoyingly, Dara O'Brien and some of his TV comedy mates have done it on a plane. So,
right,
but that man will do anything for a British Airways sandwich if it's complimentary. So, you know, you've had it on your podcast, you know.
So have you done some, you know, Everest related material? Are you doing some jokes about Yetis and all that stuff?
Well, it's tough, isn't it? We've got 10 days to get there, right? So the trek just to get there is 10 days. So basically we're hoping to just write it on the way. I have got, I was talking to a friend. And I said, he said, who's the audience? And I said, well, you know, it's other trekkers and Sherpas. And also it's going to be some of the climbers because we're there in the right season for the climbers who are actually going to attempt to climb Everest, which I think, just for the record, is an insane thing to do. Because obviously you've got quite a high chance of death. So
there's quite a few bodies, aren't there, between base camp and they're just preserved forever from the 1930s
and if you're really
or whatever.
Sick and macabre, you can go on YouTube, Simon, you can look at videos of those bodies.
Really?
But never do that because I just sit to normal, wholesome content like WikiFeet. So there's that. But so I was telling my friend this and he was like, so you know what that means? It means that for some of these people, this will be the last comedy they ever see.
Wow.
I was like, oh, we better be funny. Yeah,
you should open with that.
And then I told that story to someone else the other day and they were like, you've got to use that in the show. You've got to say that in the show. And I'm like, I don't know how funny people are going to find that. And then what if one of them does die? Like,
you could definitely do a joke about you dying if no one laughs, I suppose.
Oh, we'll work it out. We always do.
We'll work it out. Yeah.
At the end of the day, the tickets are £1. Do you know what I mean? If they're going to complain, they can buckle.
Well, tell me about when games first entered your life. So, were you playing games at a young age?
I do remember the first time I ever saw a video game, and as I am, I'm very old. I do remember it was at my friends, Megan and Nancy's house, and they had, I think, they had, these are the rubber keys. What's the rubber key ones? The
Spectrum, yeah.
Spectrum, yeah. And obviously the rubber keys were very, very fast. I must have been about six, I don't know. And they had Jet Set Willy. And I do remember seeing that and going, oh, you can press a button and it makes the telly do, it makes something happen on the telly, and thinking that was mad. But their house was brilliant as well, because this is the 80s, right? They still had an air raid shelter in their garden.
Oh, wow, cool.
It's like an actual underground corrugated iron air raid shelter, which you could go in and sort of hang out in. Because again, in the 80s, nobody worried about things like that collapsing on children's heads and suffocating them. It was just a different time. It was like nuclear holocaust, might be a bomb down there, doesn't matter.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah. And that was the first time I remember seeing one. And I remember, I just remember that so vividly. It was properly
yeah,
like,
bad.
What's that? What's that?
Yeah.
Yeah. You look at it now, of course, it's like CFAX, it's a piece of shit. But it was mind-blowing at the time.
Yeah, it was so popular, wasn't it, Jet Set Willy? Willy, it was like a real phenomenon in Britain at that time, wasn't it?
As I say, there wasn't a lot else to do.
Yeah. And so did you get a Spectrum at some point, or what was the first computer your family got hold of?
I never got a Spectrum. My dad had an Amstrad 8512, I think it was, word processor, which was black and white. So he had some text games on that were always impossibly right. hard. And then at a church jumble set. And then I said, we'd go around richer friends' houses and play their machines, but we could never afford one. And then I went to a church jumble sale and I found like an old, was it a Binatone, or like a Pong, like properly with the twisty mm-hmm. controllers.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I brought that home and I hooked it up to the TV and was able to play an appalling tennis game that looked like a photocopy for about half an hour, at which point I was very bored. And then, of course, I'd managed to detune all the television channels. My dad was absolutely furious. So that was, well, I think that was 50p or wow. something, the first console I ever owned. Yeah.
Well, the premise of the podcast, Ellie, is I've asked you to pick the five video games you want to install in your very own perfect games machine. Your first one, I guess, is from not too long after that. Can you tell us about it? From 1988. What's the game and how did you first encounter it and why did you love it?
Oh, the first game I have chosen, Simon. I feel like we're on a game show. The first game I have chosen is New Zealand Story, Cue Montage. So I first played this game at my friend Rosalind's house. So Rosalind, she was an only child and had richer parents than me. So she had those two things going for her. And I used to love going to her house because it was in Dunwich, very nice. And her parents were both theatrical types, Graham and Trish, lovely, lovely people. And they would have the Les Miserables soundtrack on all day, which I thought was just marvellous. Mm. Yeah, and she had an Amiga. Which again was something that we never had in my family. And she had Amiga, and it had, I think, three games. We had Thundercats. We liked that, but we couldn't get far past the first level. So, and we had Buggy Boy, which was a little kart racing thing, which was quite fun. And we had New Zealand Story, which, if you've not played it, is this game where you're a little yellow, I think you're a Kiwi or something, and you're on this little island in, well, New Zealand, obviously, the clue's in the name. And there's a giant walrus. I can't. It now feels like a dream, now I'm describing it to you, but it did really happen.
Yeah.
And I really loved it. So years later, when I got my first computer, my dad bought me a second-hand Amstrad CPC 464 and drove me to Shepherd's Bush to collect it, which you'll never let me forget because we live in South East London. That's like going to Aberdeen, basically. And that was one of the first games I bought for it for £3.99 in the game shop in Bromley. I bought New Zealand Story and all the memories came flooding back. And eventually I completed it, which we were never able to do on the Amiga. Aww. So, oh, gold memories.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Are you still in contact with that friend?
I am. I saw her just the other week.
Did you?
She came, lovely Rosie. She came to our show in Catford.
Oh.
She's got two sons as well, but she lives out in the country now. But we, it's one of those friendships you've had all your life. So you sort of, it doesn't matter that you can't go to the pub every week or that you don't even chat on WhatsApp every day. You know, we just send each other little messages now and again. And or we'll often hear something funny on the radio or something, or, you know, about a game we used to play or something and have a laugh about that.
Oh.
So, yeah, that's
nice. Oh, that's so nice, yeah. And you, I mean, the cliche is that, I suppose, in the 80s, and early 90s as well, like video games were just the preserve of boys. Like that's the what was presented in media and on telly and films and all that. But it seems like you and your friend Roslyn were the not the exception to the rule, but you had found a little friend to play games with. Did you have any sense that this was something that wasn't meant to be for girls, or was it not like that at all?
I didn't know, to be honest. And again, as I say, the first game I saw was with other women or girls, Megan and Nancy. Like I just didn't realise till I was older that it was this thing for boys. And I think even when I got into like the sort of Sega Nintendo era, those games were sort of almost Disney-like, weren't they, in certain terms of the bright colours and the sort of safety. I didn't realise there was this whole other world to come of Doom and FIFA and Call of Duty. All those games you people with testicles like. And so, yeah, it wasn't until I was older that I was conscious that liking games was an unusual or weird thing for a girl at all. No.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's how it should be, and I wish it continued to be like that. But and you're...
But you people, with your bloody meetings of the patriarchy, right, Simon, what are we going to do this week to fuck the birds up? Oh, I tell you what, why do we make them feel weird for playing video games? Fucking brilliant. Right, Jeff, write that down. Write it on the whiteboard.
I can't believe you got hold of our minutes, Ellie. Oh, my God.
Well, because you had to do them over Zoom in the lockdown, you see.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I've been capturing it all.
So you mentioned your dad. They're driving you to Shepherd's Bush heroically. His name's Jim Barclay, isn't it? And he was an alternative, even comic, in the 80s, wasn't he? And well, you were aware of that part of his life, that, you know, he was performing alongside pretty famous people, Alexei Sayle and people like that. Was that part of it?
Oh, he never stops banging on about all that. Yeah, no, he was. Yeah. So he was one of the first wave of alternative comedians. And you don't really hear the term alternative comedy much anymore, but it is, for anyone who doesn't know, it's comedians, they sort of were like, hang on a minute, let's not do racist jokes or mother-in-law jokes or, you know, or there are other things we can make fun of, like Thatcher and stuff like that. Thatcher was a very big thing for my dad. So, yeah, I grew up, sort of, knowing that he did that, not really understanding it and not really giving much of a monkey's. Just a couple of years ago, so in my double act now, Scummy Mummies, with Helen, we wear these gold cat suits. That's our signature look. And a couple of years ago, I found a photo of him in a gold cat suit.
No way.
And I'd forgotten that he used to do a character called Wonder Wally, who was an alien from the planet Zanussi and had come to Earth and all this. And there's this photo where I'm like, oh my God, I've ripped off my dad's act. But I'm not paying for him. It's tough luck.
Did he ever take you along to any of his shows, or was it all happening very late at night?
Mostly it was the Comedy Store. So mostly it was late at night in Uptown and I wasn't there. But he used to do a lot of benefits. They used to do a lot of rallies for CND and the Anti-Nazi League and the miners' strike and all that super right-wing stuff. He claims to have done a benefit gig in Hyde Park to 1 million people.
Wow.
I don't know. I don't know that you can fit 1 million people in Hyde Park, but that's what he claims. Wow.
Him and Taylor Swift, they broke the 1 million mark in Hyde Park.
That's right. Jim Barclay, Taylor Swift, they're both right up there with the Thatcher jokes. Hers are very good, actually. I don't know. But they had to stop taking me to like CND rallies because I started having nightmares about the nuclear bomb coming from Russia and killing us all. So we had to stop going to Greenham Common. We just went to Thorpe Park instead the next week, and I had a much better time.
Especially with Jet Set Willy in the nuclear bunker at the end of the road. It's quite impressive for you.
This is my thing. Like, for you, right? We're of a similar age, are we?
Yeah.
Born in, what, 2000? Sure, 2003. Was your childhood like dominated by the perpetual threat of nuclear holocaust? Because it often feels like mine sort of was.
I was aware of it. I don't know if I ever, because you sometimes see on YouTube those videos that were made, I guess, by the BBC or whatever, you know, telling you to get under your desk in the event of a nuclear winter. But I don't remember seeing any of those at the time. But
no. Well, I do remember that as well, because my dad had this whole, one of his whole routines was about this booklet called Protect and Survive, which he still has, actually. He still has the original thing.
Right.
And the government sent this out to all the households in Britain, I think. And it was like, how to survive a nuclear holocaust.
Oh, my God.
Like, one of the things was you should build like a tunnel out of all the doors in your house. Like, you should build a shelter out of all the doors in your house. Take them all off the hinges and build a shelter. And it said, and if you can't do this, contact your landlord. And the idea that you would ring this 80s landlord and go, I'm worried about this nuclear bomb. And your landlord will go,
No problem, Susan. I'll be right round with my hammer and my nails. We'll sort it out. So my dad had this whole bit about you should get all the net curtains with all your neighbours and sew them together and catch the bomb. And it was very good, actually. But yeah, so I saw him do that routine many times. So no wonder I had nightmares.
Yeah, cool. That's so intense. Oh my gosh. And you, at this stage, you're playing games and they've got this appeal because they're at your friend's house, and that's always nice, isn't it, when you get to go there. And it's not something that's always accessible. You sort of have to go somewhere to play it, which I think can increase their appeal. Did you have a sense that you maybe wanted to work around video games when you got a bit older, or did you have other dreams when you were a kid?
I had three dreams when I was a child. One was to be a video games journalist, and the other two were to be an astronaut or an air hostess. Nice. So... I'm only 45. There's still time, I feel like. Yeah, I did want to do that. And I used to read this magazine called Amstrad Action, which was, I think, written entirely by boys. But again, that didn't really put me off because my parents were, as I think we've established, super woke and right on. There was this sense of you can do whatever you like. Yeah. And my dad, did stupid stuff for a living. And my mum was a teacher, and then she wrote children's books.
Oh,
so
nice. Yeah.
There was this idea in the house that, you don't have to be a lawyer or a doctor. You can just basically do what you like. And if that's video games journalism, well, whatever, as long as it's not, it's not depressing. Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's poorly paid or whatever. So I was quite lucky.
Yeah,
in that
that's
respect.
Amazing. Yeah. Have you tried to, jumping forward slightly, but have you tried to keep that attitude with your own children?
Yeah, definitely. I think.
Or are you like, go and study law?
Yes. No. Listen, get the abacus out, get the violin. In 6 hours, you can play PlayStation. No, I've definitely tried to encourage that. At the same time, I think it's good to have... Oh, God, I sound so old, don't I? But it's good to have skills, and it's good to have... To be able to make money, let's be honest, to be able to pay the bills. It's all very well saying, I'm going to let my children be whatever they like. But if they decide they want to be, in a boy band and they can't fucking sing, then they're fucked, aren't they? So it'd be quite good if they could... know how to write something or do a little bit of maths or stuff like that. So I think everything with parenting, it's about balance,
yeah,
isn't it?
Is. Yeah, indeed. All right, why don't we come to your second game then, which is from 1996. Can you tell us about it? What is it and why do you love it?
Oh, which is this Tomb Raider? Which one is this? Yeah. Oh, look, Simon, I know it's really boring. Oh, surprise, surprise. She's a 45-year-old middle-aged female gamer. She's picked Tomb Raider. Unbelievable. The listeners are dropping their headphones, ripping them out of their ears in shock and awe.
It's funny. I had Susan Cowan on. I don't think it's not gone out yet, but she picked Tomb Raider as well. But
Of course she did.
To typecast lady comedians.
No, and don't make me feel inferior by telling me that a much funnier and more successful comedian has picked the thing I've got to talk about. In no way has that put me off my stride, Simon. That's absolutely fine.
Oh, come on.
No, joking.
So did you play this at the time in 1996?
So again, I remember really vividly, I first saw Tomb Raider. It must have been the summer of maybe 97 or something, I'm not sure. It's the summer Diana died. It's all coming back to me now. 1997. Oh, how we wept. And there were two very important women in my life that summer, Simon Parkin. Princess Diana and Princess Lara. Oh, yeah. Now, I remember that because that was the summer I was working in a bakery in Nunhead. And I was a student and I really needed the money. So I went and worked in this bakery. And I found out after about a month that the boss was racist. Which obviously is really awful, but I couldn't afford to quit my job or like report her. So what I did was I decided to take my revenge by stealing cakes. So because that's what Martin Luther King wanted. That's what Malcolm X would have suggested, I'm sure, in my circumstances. At the end of the day, I would just quietly put a gatto on the back of my bike, and then I would take it round to my friend Owen's house because Owen's parents were away for the summer. So him and his brother Stephen had the house to themselves. So we used to hang out there. Owen would barbecue for 6 to 8 hours every day while smoking. And then I would turn up like a hero with these anti-racist cakes.
I stole these cakes from a racist. This is allyship.
Exactly. Just call me Robin Hood. That's it. And I allowed anyone of any race to eat those cakes, Simon. That's very important to say. I'm not proud of it, but it's the thing that I did. And I looked her up to report her recently and she's dead. So anyway.
Racism doesn't pay.
Doesn't pay. So I remember going into the smoke-filled living room and seeing Stephen playing this game that was just this woman wandering around what looked like a multi-story car park, a sort of abandoned car park. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing? And he's like, this game's brilliant. And I was like, no, it isn't. You're really high. That's just a woman in a big grey room. That's that. Like nothing was happening in it. I was like, what are you doing? Where's the baddies? Where's the pew-pews? Where's the Sonic's red shoes? Where's the green pipes? And even then, it didn't really register with me that she was a female character or the importance of that sort of, you know, it wasn't like a great feminist awakening.
Right.
But then for some reason, then I did get to play it maybe there or somewhere else. Again, that summer is all very hazy. Can't remember if it was before or after Diana's tragic death. But I got to play it and suddenly something did click in me. And I was just like... Oh, I get it. This isn't a game like Mario Kart where you all sit in a smoke-filled room and you all play it and you all laugh. This is a solo experience. It's entirely designed to put you as an isolated person in this world and you explore at your own pace and your own leisure. And it's such a quiet game. Oh, and then there's these puzzles that you've got to solve. But again, you think through them in your own time. It's not about running and jumping, you know, all the time jumping on the baddie's head. And that was revelatory to me. So there's that. And yeah, the fact that, of course, it had an impact on me that she was a girl, because there were no, apart from Princess Peach and Ms. Pac-Man, there were no other girls in games then, certainly that didn't wear pink. So the idea of being this incredibly athletic, acrobatic, intelligent woman with enormous bangers, I was like, that would be fucking good, wouldn't it? Let's go.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, it was such a... It's difficult to remember now if you weren't there at the time, but it was such a momentous thing, wasn't it, really?
Did it have the same impact on you then?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly was... It was such a something new. Exactly as you say, you know, Miss Pac-Man was just Pac-Man, but with a bow sprite. Like, so it wasn't a meaningful... change, but
why did she have the bow anywhere? Was it, she didn't have any hair? Was it to cover her vagina? Is that where people have their genitals? I don't know. It's very strange.
It is strange, yeah. No, it was just different, wasn't it, to see a woman protagonist who was a fully fleshed out character, right, with motivations and a lovely house.
Yeah, well, fleshed out is the word. Yeah,
yeah. There was that, I suppose, as well.
That's part of the.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Phil.
So you, I mean, you're working at this bakery. How do you get from the bakery to Sony PlayStation, where you joined in 2001?
So after the stint at the racist bakery, I went back to uni, where I did an English degree. What I mainly did, of course, was from that point on was play Tomb Raider. My friend and I
we got whole, I think we it was at Christmas, we got the last PlayStation in Bromley. It was that year when there was a drought.
Nice.
And we got the last one. I think we bought it in WH Smith's. Do you remember when Smith's used to sell games and consoles?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Days. And we basically played that and drank vodka and Coke all Christmas. And then I took it back with me to uni, and that's just sort of what I did. And I lived with these people who were really nice, but had like proper, were doing proper degrees in like environmental geoscience. And they'd come in and go, so how's your post-graduation plan going? I've just had an interview with Procter & Gamble. And I'd be like, oh, I've got the scion of a Gnathsnaroth. I've just unlocked the key for the temple, so I'm going to do that now. And they'd be like, oh, okay. When I left uni, I didn't have a plan, but I had a friend, the friend who I would play the game with, actually, and he had this job on this in this TV company coming up. But it was one of those things where things take ages to... So there was a period of unemployment where I couldn't afford, I had no money, I was living with my parents. And the highlight of my week was going to the Lewisham Library in Catford, where I would rent Angel of Darkness. I think it was £3. So another Tomb Raider game. Unfortunately, a terrible one. But I played that for a bit. And anyway, I'd worked at the telly company for a bit, and then that ended. And then again, I was just unemployed and I didn't know what to do. And I saw an advert in the newspaper for a copywriter at PlayStation, and I didn't even know what copywriter was, but I was like, oh, that's, you know, PlayStation, brilliant. So I applied for it, so did over 300 other people, but miraculously I got the job.
Do you remember the interview, what they asked you?
There was a three stage interview. There was a sort of meet, just a normal interview, and then I think there was another chat. I had to do weird stuff, like I had to write some plot ideas for Brookside.
What?
Yeah, I had to write like 3 pages of plot lines for Brookside. After I got the job, I said, what was that about? And the guy was like, well, I wanted to make sure that you could turn your hand to any kind of writing, because you have to write about different kinds of games. And I'm just a really big fan of Brookside.
Maybe they were like hoping to like pitch some move into script writing. And they just wanted to take your ideas or something.
Yeah, it was all odd.
So strange.
But then the final sort of interview, they said, we want you to come in one more time. They said, it's down to you and one other person. Come into the office in Golden Square. So I came in. And they sat me down in this little room with a PlayStation 2. And the PlayStation 2 wasn't even out yet. So as a gamer, this was like
pretty cool.
Willy Wonka giving you an everlasting gobstopper. I was just like, what? And they were like, we're just going to leave you here for a few minutes. And yeah, I've just got to go and check something. I'll be right back. I was like, and they were like, just play the game. Just have a play. Just see how you feel. It was Sky Odyssey, the playing game. And I just picked up the controller and I started playing it. And loved it, and it was awesome. And then after about 10 minutes, they came back in and they went, oh, hi, how are you getting on? And I was like, yeah, brilliant. I'm just doing this bit. And they were like, oh, cool, you've got the job. And I was like, oh, I thought you had to check. And they were like, no. I said, I thought there was another candidate. And they were like, no, you've got the job. That's all fine. It was odd, but I was just really happy and pleased. And it wasn't until months later that I was at a party and a drunk person said to me, we wanted to check that you really weren't bluffing us and that you really knew your way around a PlayStation.
No.
Because, and that he actually said, because you're a girl, we wanted to make sure that you weren't,
you know,
it wasn't all just sort of a big bluff.
So it's like a two-way mirror that they're all stood behind to see what you do.
See if I still put the controller in my bra. I don't know. Accidentally put it in my vagina because I don't know what they thought I was going to do. Yeah. And when they told me, you know, I was 23 and it's different. It was a different time. And I just sort of went, oh, that's so funny. Oh, cool. I'm glad I passed that test. And now, of course, I look back on it and go, ooh, how fucking dare you?
Of course. Yeah, that's scandalous.
But, you know, it is what it is.
Oh, my gosh. I actually read a piece that you wrote when I was preparing for this about working on those game manuals. And you had a you wrote a story about the writing the manual for Time Crisis 2, and you had to write some backstory. Is this right for the special agents Keith Martin and Robert Baxter?
Keith and Robert, that's right.
Can you just tell us that story? What you did?
So yeah, was it Time Crisis 3 Project Titan? It might have been. I can't remember. One of the Time Crisis games. So you'd get these manuals like from Namco, from these sort of Japanese games, and then their manuals would be translated from Japanese into English. And the English wouldn't be great because the person doing the translating wasn't a native speaker. And God knows it was still better than my Japanese will ever be, right? But then they would send them to me and then I would sort of convert that English into, you know, the house style, the European style. I was allowed a little bit of creative freedom with that. And to be honest, I loved working at PlayStation. It was a magic rock and roll time to be there, but it was a bit dull just writing manuals and the bits. So I just get a bit bored. So I made up these biographies for Robert and Keith, the agents in Time Crisis, that they were from Lewisham, because I was like, why not?
Yeah,
Let's localise it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the manager used to say, and he used to say their blood type and stuff, which is a very Japanese thing. And it had like hobbies. And I put like, I think, lead singer of Fleetwood Mac tribute band. And I sent it to the product manager, and he was a good laugh, Stephen. He got it, and he was like, yep, fine. And he sent it on to Namco, and Jackie from Namco sent it back with a big pig post-it note on it saying, where did your copyright get our information from about the beer from Lewisham? Sadly, got in big trouble for writing a, do you remember the multi-tap, the four-way?
I do, yeah.
Multi-tap. Got in big trouble for writing an advert for that. For Smash Court Tennis, that said "fancy a foursome." They didn't like that. They said, "Oh, that my wasn't...
God! You were the toxic copywriter in the early 2000s, making everything sexy."
I wrote something for the E3 brochure about Ape Escape, where I used the phrase "spank the monkey," and the head of marketing saw it just before it went to print. Was really upset with me.
It's like on Twitter these days, you often see people posting pics of like game adverts from that era going, oh my gosh, I can't believe they did. And that was all you.
That was me.
People were like, I can't believe those men working in advertising in Soho would write these things, but it was all Ellie. okay, let's. Should we come to your third game, which I think is relevant to this era from 2001, a PlayStation game. Can you tell us about it?
It's Jak and Daxter. So again, for anyone who doesn't know, so this is a classic PS2 game, and it was one of the first games I wrote the manuals for, and it was the first ones I wrote the manual sort of from scratch. So it's an American game, it's made by Naughty Dog, I'm not sure what they've done since, probably nothing much, just miserable stuff really, isn't it? Why didn't they just stick with the happy, joyful, sandy beaches of Jak and Daxter? No one knows, everyone's got to eat each other. Anyway, so Jak and Daxter was this lovely game, and... when I first saw it, again, it was one of those moments where it's like, I saw a preview code, obviously, in the office, and it was all this top secret thing, and I'd never seen anything quite like it. It had the sort of lush sort of beauty of the old Sonic and Mario games, which I loved, but then it had this sort of 3D element, and it had this, this idea that you're in this world that you could explore relatively freely, and I loved it, and the artwork was just exquisite. One of my first jobs was... They were like, so Naughty Dog have sort of put together a sort of a rough manual, but we want you to make that, you know, better. And we know that the sidekick is called Daxter, but we can't pick a name for the blonde hero guy. So one of my first jobs was just to go away and come up with loads of suggestions.
No way.
So I came up with about 40, including things like, you know, bum face and giant arse. They didn't like that. But one of them was, again, that the person I was living with some friends at the time, and the guy I would play Tomb Raider with was called Jake. And for shorthand, we used to call him Jack-Jack in the house. I don't know why. And so I just wrote Jack-Jack on the thing. And they came back said, oh, we like that, but we're going to shorten it. We're going to call him Jack. So there you are. And it was spelt like that. So that I named Jack out of Jak and Daxter.
You did. I did not know that. That's incredible. Wow.
Fun facts.
And if that had been the Naughty Dog project that was turned into a... lavish HBO production, you could have had a windfall.
Oh, do you know what I have got? They did send me a beautiful and enormous, like, sort of watercolor print of the artwork of Jak and Daxter signed by the artists and stuff. I think they're like limited edition thing. And I have got that just over there. And I shouldn't be telling you in case burglars, but I've got that tucked away. But again, I'm sort of banking on that IP becoming Naughty Dog's like multi-million dollar franchise. And it just hasn't. I don't think it's going to happen, Simon. But I did all sorts of pretentious stuff like that. So that game had its own alphabet. They very cleverly came up with this thing, the precursors, these robots, and they had their own alphabet, like hieroglyphic sort of thing. So around the manual is like a fold-out map, which I think was my idea, but I better not say that. It's like a fold-out map of the island. And it had this border, and I said, I want you to put for the border the alphabet, but I want you to write. And then I gave them some lines from Tennyson, the Kraken, so that if you bothered to translate that border. That's actually some lines from Tennyson about these monsters rising from the deep, which of course is the plot of the game. But whenever I tell that to people, they just tell me that's incredibly pretentious and what a wanker I am.
Oh, well, you're telling the right person because I love that. That's so great. I love it.
I thought Brilliant. You would like it, Simon Parkin, because you're an award-winning book writer.
That is great. Oh, I love it. No, but that attention to detail, who can't love that? That's brilliant stuff, isn't it? Especially, you know, the art of manual design has sort of been lost, hasn't it, in recent years? And it's so lovely to look at those older projects where there was proper care and attention spent on them. So I'm a fan.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I miss the notes. I miss the pages at the back where you could write the little blank pages for notes. Just last night on my stream, so to reward people for subscribing, I don't have any fancy flashy alerts. So to reward people lately, or last night, I've been reading out excerpts from Starlight, the Enya fanzine, which is a magazine produced in 2011. And it's like 45 pages. I let people pick a random number and then I read them whatever on the page. That's the reward.
Right.
But I've had to say only between 1 and 40 because the last four pages are blank. And one of my viewers was like, is that so in case you want to write some notes about Enya? It's like, yeah, maybe you want to do a watercolour of one of her videos. I don't know.
A walkthrough of her house or something to remind you where the treasure's hidden or something. Did you have to say where Jack was from? Is he from Lewisham?
No, sadly they're Americans. They took it all quite seriously, all that sort of thing. Yeah. But they did allow me like quite a lot of creative freedom with it. So it was really fun to work with them.
Yeah, amazing.
But as I say, now they've gone on to make all these bloody miserable games where everybody's eating each other. So, you know, I'm not really interested in them anymore.
They've lost their way. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then, you know, like you say, it was a good job, but it got a little tedious at some point, and then you make the decision to move into journalism. How did that happen?
Well, I really loved working there and I loved the people, but then I had this Australian boyfriend that I met here, and then he decided to go back to Australia, and then I was going to go with him, but then he dumped me. But then I decided to go around the world anyway, and I flew to Thailand and sort of got stuck there, got into scuba diving, stayed there for a bit, and then I went to Vietnam and sort of got stuck there. And I ended up working for the Vietnam News, which is an English language newspaper. So then, and it was all, that was all hilarious. It was a government run newspaper because Vietnam's not a democracy.
They told you what to write then?
Well, it was things like, when the first person died of SARS, it was around that time.
Right.
Someone had died of SARS and they died of SARS in the Western hospital, because obviously that's a big, if a white person dies in a white person's hospital, that's a massive deal, right? And my boss was like, oh, I've just got your thing. Can you not write that they're dead? Can you write that they're in a critical condition?
Oh, right.
Like, no, because they're dead. And I was like, and I've got that off the, well, that's from the Associated Press. Like, that's not me. I haven't been to the hospital. Like, that's what it says on the wires. It's in the public domain. Yeah, and he's like, yeah, but the paper goes out on all the aeroplanes that come into Vietnam. So people will be like really freaked out if you say that someone's dead. I was like, but someone's dead.
Yeah, that's the point of the news.
So it's just stuff like that.
Oh my gosh.
But that meant that I could go back to, and that was an ideal job because it started at noon and finished at 9:30 at night, at which point we just go out drinking. But then, so when I got back, I could pretend, well, I could say that I had worked on a national newspaper and no one else had to know it was produced using literally Word 2.0. And it was basically rewriting government propaganda about the marvellous uptick in catfish exports, which I wrote. I wrote about four stories about that a day under the instructions of the government. So that was good. So that I had that. And then I worked, I tried, I got offered two jobs. One was on a magazine, a games magazine in Macclesfield. And one was where I lived in London in PR. And the PR one was like thousands of times better paid. So I took that one and lasted about a week. It was like, I don't think I can do this anymore. Because I finished
it.
So
it was
games.
PR for games, was it?
Yeah. Yeah. I had to write a press release for like a WWE game. And I think I wrote a lot of stuff about, again, like waggling your joy, get ready to waggle your joysticks as the ladies of the WWE. Because that was the thing about this version. It had the women in it. And it was such a disgraceful press release. I think a question got asked about it in Parliament.
Oh, gosh. Like, that's. It sounds like you should have been working at FHM.
We should be invited to your meetings. This is what I'm saying. I want to come to the patriarchy meetings. I've got loads of ideas for you, marketing-wise. So I finished all the games PR in a week, and then they were like, oh, you've completed it. Well, we'll put you on one of our other like teams. Can you run some competitions for Rory McGrath's Own Goals and Sporting Blunders Volume 2 DVD and also Jeremy Clarkson's Motorsport? And I was like, no, I hate these things, but I had to do it. I did get them in a competition got them a competition in Viz, which they were really impressed with. But then after I'd left, the competition came out and it was, one unlucky winner will receive 10 copies of Rory McGrath's Own Golf Sporting Punters. So that was good. So anyway, so I'd been there about a week and I thought, this is not, and I rang the magazine up and I said, is that a job still going? And they were like, yeah. And I was like, and Noah said I didn't want it, but I've made a big mistake. And they were like, that's fine. Get on the train to Macclesfield. So I went and did that. And then that lasted.
You moved your whole life then to Macclesfield?
I did, yeah. I moved up to Mac and wasn't there for too long. And that's when I actually got together with Pete, because Pete, he used to come and visit me up there. And we'd been friends for a long time. And that's when we sort of started seeing each other. And yeah, and again, that was loads of fun. Really brilliant people who I'm still friends with now. Loved all that. But after just over a year, the magazine, the company started going bust, basically. And by the end, it was just me and one other guy, Paul, putting together this issue of the magazine. And we worked our asses off doing it. We wrote the whole thing ourselves. And then it never appeared. And then they kept saying, there's been a fire in the warehouse.
Oh, jeez.
And in the end, they were like, yeah, we never printed it. We've run out of money. And then they said, do you want a job on Simply Cards and Papercraft? And I said, no, I don't. And again, I never thought about this at the time, but interestingly, I don't think they offered that job to Paul. I think it was just me. And I said, no, I don't. And they said, we thought you'd say that. Here's your redundancy check. We've already written it out. So I'm fine. And then I got a job on Eurogamer, because I was booked to go on a press trip for this magazine. And then it folded. But the lovely Kat Channon was like, she worked for Vivendi then, was like, just come anyway. Just come on the press trip anyway. And she and I were pretty much instant best friends. And that's where I met Tom Bramwell, who worked for Eurogamer. And then off we went.
I didn't know some of that. That's super interesting. So let's come to your fourth game, which is more recent. This is from 2020. Can you tell us about it?
It's Assassin's Creed Valhalla. I worked at Eurogamer for nearly a decade. I loved that. But then I started having babies, and Eurogamer, great. But I went part-time, and then I just, it wasn't working. So, and also I'd met Helen Thorne and we'd started Scummy Mummies. So I quit Eurogamer and I focused on comedy for a few years. And that was all going really well. That was great. And we were selling out these shows all over the UK, and we had this hit podcast, and it was all amazing. And we booked this 40-date tour for 2020. And then everyone started coughing. And it was the lockdown. I just didn't really know what to do with myself. And I think it was the second lockdown, actually, I think, because it was January. Was it January 21 I started? I started playing Assassin's Creed Valhalla, and I hadn't played an Assassin's Creed. Oh, really? I hadn't played a proper big AAA game for years. And they'd changed quite a lot. And I was so impressed by the scope of it, just the sheer breadth and the beauty of it, the detail. And it was the first game I think I'd ever played, even more than Tomb Raider and Jack and Daxter, although they had an element of this, where you really did feel like you were in this living world, and you had total freedom to go anywhere within it. And wherever you went, something nutty would happen. And I just loved that. But it was so expansive and it was quite isolating. So I thought, I'd heard about Twitch, and I thought, let's just try it. Let's just see what happens. And I loved it.
What was it like the first time you did that? Did you sort of immediately have like an audience, and did you know how to kind of talk to them, or did that develop over a few weeks?
Oh, that definitely developed. Like the first time I went sort of live was absolutely terrifying, because partly I was like, what is this? Am I trying to be a comedian? Am I trying to be funny? or do they want information about them? Am I a games journalist? They want information about the game. Do they want to see the game? Is it like a preview? And I had all these voices in the back of my head from all the shit I used to get when I was on Eurogamer going, well, you don't know anything about games anyway, you moron, and you're not funny, so why on earth would anyone come and watch you play this game? And also, because I had all that going on in my head, I'm not brilliant at games anyway, and I was suddenly incredibly shit at the game and very conscious of that. So mentally, it was just a lot. But the people were so... And to this day, I still don't really understand what Twitch is, if I'm honest. But the people were so lovely and so funny and so supportive. And I realised it's okay to be a bit shit at games, and people actually quite like it when you're a bit shit at something and you're honest about that and vulnerable about that and just sort of own it. Since then, it's grown and grown. And to be honest, I really didn't expect to be doing it still 2 nights a week, 2 years on. I would have told you, you're mad. But here we are, and I've accidentally built this community of really lovely people who I just are some of the funniest, brightest, kindest people I've ever met. And it's just a lovely place to hang out twice a week.
That's so lovely. The thing you say there about being honest or, you know, not afraid to be a bit vulnerable in front of people, I suppose that's also part of what you have to learn as a stand-up comic as well. Can you just, I mean, I know we're going a little bit back in the timeline, but can you just tell us about, you know, what was it that made you want to give that a go, to actually get up in front of an audience? What pushed you to do that while you've got this job on Eurogamer?
Well, I'd always sort of, since I was a kid, I'd used funny to, you know, cope with, to make people try and like me, basically. I was like 99% of comedians, I was very badly bullied at school, and humour was a way to get people on side. And then I sort of found my voice in games when, you know, Pat from Eurogamer said to me, you know, stop trying to write like you think a proper serious games journalist writes. You're funny. Just write like you talk to me. And that was hugely helpful.
That's such great advice.
It was brilliant. And it sort of turned my whole career around in all sorts of ways. My life around, really. I have had this conversation with him about it and tried to say thank you, but he's very earnest and sincere and he just goes, oh. So anyway... stand up obviously it was something my dad did, but I think, to be honest, I think it was one of those things of, if you sometimes I think if you have a dream, the it's not always, I think the whole thing of always go for your dreams is not necessarily great advice, because if you go for your dreams and then you fail and you're totally shit, what have you got left? You've got no dreams. Then what are you gonna do?
Right, like, that's the thing that holds people back though, isn't it?
Trying,
isn't it?
Have you been on the open mic circuit? But I had this baby and I really liked him a lot. And I was very lucky. I had a lot of support and a nice husband. So I found the baby bit all right for me. I know that's not a lot of people's experience. I found the toddler a bit harder actually. But the baby bit for me was all right. So I was really happy. And I thought, well, I could go and try and do this thing. And if I'm shit at it and it doesn't go anywhere, it doesn't matter, because I've got all this stuff going on at home that I'm actually really happy with. And then I looked at this comedy course and it was like, yes, you get to go to a pub in Soho on your own without a child every Monday night for 6 weeks. And I was like, sign me up. I don't even care what this is. Oh, it's comedy. Oh, brilliant. Could be darts. Yeah. Could be, you know, making sourdough. Don't mind. But it was comedy. And I loved doing the course and I loved my first gig. And I think, didn't Dara say this on your podcast that I listened to actually, about the first time you do comedy and people laugh, it's like a sort of drug going into your system.
Yeah. He said, I think it was like a part of your brain that's not been turned on before gets switched on.
Yeah. And then you spend literally the rest of your life, this is my other friend said this to me as well, chasing that high and never being able to replicate it. But I did. I remember going to bed that night after my first gig and just like seeing stars, just like my brain was on fire. And I was just like, that's magic. That is magic. And since then, I've had many, many terrible gigs where, you know, and all sorts of awful things have happened, but also some great ones, but never quite that high, I guess.
Well, you mentioned there that, you know, that having a tough time at school. Did you find when you were doing these gigs and you had just bad audiences or like, you know, dickheads in the crowd or hecklers or whatever, did it sort of press those buttons from when you were younger in some way and make you think, oh my gosh, actually, what am I doing here? Or were you able to you know, contextualise that?
No, I didn't mind that too much. I didn't mind it not going well with the comedy. There's all sorts of factors involved, and it's, you know, the thing is with the Eurogamer, I had to get quite a thick skin because I did get a lot of shit. Some of it because I was a woman, sometimes just because people are assholes, basically. And I had to learn over the years to sort of, you shouldn't have to. I'm not saying anyone else should have to do this, but I had to. And I did learn to go, well, we'll fuck the internet, basically. So I had that sort of armor going into stand up. I think the reason those voices came back when I did Twitch was because, I don't know, I think it was the thing of comedy is just, it's just you talking about your own shit, right? And nobody knows your own shit better than you. Whereas games, you are expected, especially if you're positing yourself as a presenter, a game journalist or a streamer, you're supposed to have a basic knowledge of this thing. And that's one of the things I loved about Twitch is that nobody minded that I never remembered which was the button to call the horse or the I kept setting myself on fire. People just thought it was funny and they weren't calling me an idiot.
Yeah, no way, it's better.
Yeah, they weren't saying to me, because that's the thing I used to get on Eurogamer. There was this sort of undercurrent often of, she shouldn't have this job because she's not good enough at it and she doesn't know what she's doing. I should have this job. You know, I know more than her. And there was a lot of trying to prove that they knew more than me. Whereas on Twitch, you don't have that weapon, do you? Because it's like, well, you fucking do it then. You go and stream Assassin's Creed Valhalla for 97 hours. I'm not stopping you. Nobody's here because they have to be. Nobody's paying for this content, you know. Like, so that's one of the things I've enjoyed most about it.
Yes. That's brilliant.
I did tell someone to fuck off in a comedy show last week, actually. That was good as well.
Did you?
It was in Lancaster, and there were these two really piss birds up the back, and they were just chatting, which happens, it does happen more since lockdown, chatting like it, they're just in the front room, and the audience are getting really annoyed. And we tried to deal with it. You know, you try a bit of politeness, and you try a bit of passag, and you try a bit of all this stuff, and it wasn't working. And in the end, I went, what are you chatting about? And this woman in front of them just went, just tell them to fuck off. And I went, oh, is that the local vernacular? Is that the local lingo? All right, ladies, fuck off. And they fucking shut up. So there you go.
Did you get a big cheer?
Huge cheer, yes. Everybody was very happy.
Yeah, yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I think when the heckler realises probably that the entire room's against them, that's when they shrivel up a bit, isn't it?
It's hard to carry on.
Yeah. Okay, we should, Ellie, we should come to your fifth and your final game. Which is related to streaming again. Can you tell us about it from 2021?
So the game I have chosen for my final game, I don't know why I feel like I have to give it a big setup, Simon. I'm going to do it in the style of the X Factor Man. It's Power Wash Simulator! Have you played this game?
I have, actually. I think, I've played a Power Wash game. I assume this is the only one, but maybe there's more. But I've played one of them anyway, and you have to clean, objects in your garden and things like that, and patios. Is this a different one?
Yes. I'm sure this is just the start of a new... You know how games go, right? Someone does a good thing, and then everyone else copies it. Remember, Rock Band and Guitar Hero and the Wii and all that stuff. So I'm pretty sure the must-have games gadget of this Christmas is going to be like a plastic power wash peripheral
that you actually
point at your Nintendo Switch. I'm confident that's on the way.
A Call of Duty spin-off. Call of Duty power wash.
Everything. Tomb Raider power wash. Well, there is Tomb Raider power wash, of course, in the thing already. But yeah, all up for grabs.
So what's... why does this game mean a lot to you? It's quite... It's very pleasing, isn't it, washing things in real life and in the game. Is that why you loved it?
Simon Parkin loves washing things. That's your headline.
All the hard-hitting questions here.
I love to wash, said Parkin. Everything, myself, my home, my children. Right, here's the thing. You tell people about this game, right, whether they're gamers or non-gamers, it's what's good is everyone can understand what it is. So it's just a game. You're a power washer person and you have to just power wash shit. Monster trucks, bicycles, bungalows, children's playgrounds, Lara Croft's house, vehicles from Final Fantasy VII, you name it, you've got to power wash it.
Yeah.
It sounds simple. And the Guardian's Kezia MacDonald, who I believe you're close personal friends with, and she asked me to write an article about the Tomb Raider expansion pack. And I did. And she was just like, voice. And I got in so deep so quickly. Within 10 minutes, I was like, no, this is what I'm doing for at least the next 6 weeks. This is my life now. This is what we're doing. Because it's not just power washing stuff. There's depth, Simon. You get different nozzles.
You get different extenders. You can get different guns. You can buy new rubber gloves. There's all of that.
Do they give you different benefits, the rubber gloves? Or is it just cosmetics?
There's nothing wrong with taking pride in your appearance, Simon. But you saying I can't wear lipstick because I'm a feminist? Come on. No, there's nothing wrong with it. But as I wrote in my article, which Keza probably against a better judgment commissioned, there's just something so soothing about it and so satisfying. And it's one of the quietest games I've played probably since that original Tomb Raider. There's no music, you know, there's no, again, nothing jumping on you or jumping out at you. There's no silly sidekick. That's what drove me mad about the later Tomb Raider game. Some bloke standing there going, it looks like this mural might be from an old civilization and there's a drawing of a key. And like, fuck off. I don't want that. I want to be left alone in peace. I live with children, so I've got a constant narration in my life all the time. So I like to be in silence.
It would work, though, having a little sidekick going, you missed a bit in Power Wash Simulator.
Well, there's a button you press where you can see the little bits that you've missed. They flash orange.
Right.
Yeah, see? Layers. Layers.
And you once played this game for a full 24 hours, is that correct?
That's right. So I was like, now when someone else says it to you, you go, why did I do that? So then I've had the idea. So yeah, we're going to Nepal and we're going to try and break this world record. And then I was like, I really like this game. I think I could play it forever. What if? So I wrote to Guinness and I was like, is there a Guinness World Record for playing this? It's quite new. And they were like, no, but they love a games world record. And I was like, great, can I do the world record? Can I play it for 12 hours? And they were like, no, the minimum you can play it to set a record, because there isn't one existing, is 24 hours.
Gosh.
And I was like, that is a long time to wash anything. I don't even like washing things as much as Simon Parkin, but that's a long time.
Right.
But honestly, what sort of tipped the balance was, well, I can do it on Twitch. I can do it and then people can chat to me and we can have a laugh. I'm not sure I would have done it, you know, 10 years ago, to be honest, but I thought that would be, and also I'll get loads of attention, I'll get to show off. So that's what we did. And we raised over £10,000 for Born. So I had a premature baby in 2014. So it's a cause that's very important to me, and we raised over 10 grand for the Born organization. Half of that actually was from Future Lab, who make a power wash simulator. So great bunch of lads, thank you very much, and women. It was, I mean, I love the game. It at about 3 a.m I did start to go, I played from 8 a.m to 8 a.m and I did start to go a bit mad in the middle of the night, but I had my lovely Twitch buddies there, and a nice woman, just a mum from Texas, appeared on the stream for the first time. She kept me going.
Aww.
So it was really fun. And I did cry at the end of the stream. Not honestly, obviously I was very tired, but it was an amazing experience. And I don't just mean the bow washing. So to qualify for the record, I had to have two witnesses at all times, watching it and being filmed on a Zoom call watching it. I had to video the whole thing. I had to have mods obviously doing the stream. And my community just came together and were like volunteering, like to do shifts from like 3 a.m. till 6 a.m. watching me play this fucking video game about pile washing. And they did it, and they all did their witness statements the same day, and they were all just absolutely amazing, and they were donating money and telling me to keep going. And I was just absolutely floored by the level of commitment and kindness that people had. So I did a little Oscar speech, burst into tears. I haven't been able to watch it back yet on the video on demand. I'm too nervous.
Oh, that's so lovely, though. Amazing. And like a great way to celebrate what you've built on Twitch, isn't it? Your community there and everything. So nice.
I think so. Like I said, I've been doing it for 2 years, and I still, you know, we have a sort of joke where very often I start the stream by saying, welcome to whatever this is, because I don't know what it is, really. It doesn't seem to matter what we play. We play Assassin's Creed or we play Power Wash Simulator. For a while, we were streaming interactive erotic fiction, or for a period, there was a period where we played Dead Space, but punctuated where I would read, if it got a bit too dark, if someone subscribed, I would read a bit from Craig David's self-help autobiography, What's My Vibe? I like to just mix it up. And yet people seem to stick around, or they go away and they come back, which is always lovely. And it's just a joy. It's a joy I really never expected to be this fulfilling, to be honest. But it's good.
Oh, I'm so pleased. Amazing, Ellie. Right, let's go through your console. Then we've got New Zealand Story, Tomb Raider, Jack and Daxter, as named by Ellie Gibson, Assassin's Creed Valhalla, and Power Wash Simulator. Something for everyone there, I think.
I think that's a good balance. What? So what is this like? Are we on a desert island with this console? Like, what's the?
No, it's a very different concept to that, Ellie. No desert islands are a part of this.
Well then.
No, we're making making like a SNES Mini. That's the idea that we're going to market to the world. So
because I've got all these games anyway, so I don't.
No,
really...
but this is the one that you're going to put it. Don't pick at the premise. No, we're going to. This is what you're going to bundle up, and it's going to be like the Ellie Gibson machine that people are going to play to get a sense of who you are. It's got very limited memory. That's why it's only got 5 games. Okay.
Can it? Assassin's Creed Valhalla is about 80 gig. You fucked it yourself there.
Yeah.
Can it come with the Power Wash Simulator plastic peripheral, like a guitar?
Oh.
Like,
absolutely, a pack-in version with a peripheral. But you do need to give it a name. So what would you like to call this console that we market to the world? You're good
with
names.
I'm going to call it in honour of... Because you only asked me about my favourite games. You didn't ask me about my favourite consoles. In honour of my favourite video games console of all time, I'm going to call it the Gibzondo.
Yes.
Yes.
After the Gibzondo. I know you've got some good stories about that project. But...
Oh, so many.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we might have to get you back to talk about that.
Do a Gibzondo special. We can talk through what games we put on the Gibzondo console, but there's only about 5 anyway.
You've already done it. Okay, perfect. So wait, just remind me what it was.
Gibzondo, as in Gibson.
Gibzondo.
Gibzondo.
Yeah.
If you have to explain a joke, that always means it's funny, I find. Yeah.
No. So, right, listen, before I let you go, Ellie. So I've been to a couple of your Scummy Mummy gigs. We haven't really talked about all of that, but just a tremendous vibe. I saw you at Edinburgh in that it was that year when it was not quite finished with the pandemic, but it was so raucous in there and wonderful. I really absolutely loved it. I have heard you talk a bit. I think you were with on the, is it the Fortunately podcast? This was probably a few years ago, but you were talking about how, you know, you have these really successful gigs all around the country where lots of people come along and have the time of their lives. But getting that, moving that onto TV has always sort of seemed like a bit of a problem because, I don't know, executives don't think that parents want comedy about parenting or something like that. I don't know. Do you think is that shifting? Do you think that's going to change anytime soon?
Well, specifically, they've said to us literally they don't think men want comedy about parenting.
That's not true.
They've literally said to us, you know, we think your material might alienate a male audience. So I'm glad it didn't alienate you, Simon, when you came to see the show. Otherwise, this would have been a very awkward podcast. But you know, I think it is changing, and I really hope it is. And I think that's brilliant. Like, if you look at the success of Motherland, which is a fantastic show, and that came out after, you know, we had that conversation I was just talking about. I don't think you can argue anymore that there's no appetite for comedy with the parenting. And I think Josh Widdicombe and Rob Beckett, they've got, you know, Parenting Hell, their podcast has been hugely successful. They've got a live show and stuff based on that. So I think...
They are men doing comedy about parenting, in fact.
See, that's a whole different thing, isn't it? There you go.
Oh, I see.
So I think it's getting to a point where you can't sort of ignore that anymore. I mean, to be honest, obviously I'd be lying if I didn't say, of course we'd love to be on the telly, of course we'd love to do a Scummy Mummy's telly show. But I think for a while that was the goal, that was the end, sort of the boss level, if you like. And it's not anymore, certainly for me, because, you know, we do really well, we're making money, to be honest, and we love doing the show.
Millions, in fact.
Literally millions and millions of pounds. That's my net worth. Yeah. That's right. And my feet are very, very famous. And that was always a personal goal. And I just really like my life. I really like not working for myself, but being able to choose what I do with my time. I like traveling around the country with my best mate and often my dad, staying in premier inns, eating at nice restaurants. I like being able to make time to see my kids. I get to go to all the school plays and all that stuff because we plan all our stuff around that. I like to be able to go off on stupid adventures to Everest. And I think a few years ago, I had to have a sit down and kind of go, Do I still really want that? And what is the goal? And is it all right if that doesn't happen? And I was like, yeah. It wasn't even like I had to talk myself round. I was like, no, actually, this is pretty great. And we don't know how long it's going to last. It could all go tits up tomorrow. So I think we're just focused on enjoying it. This is our 10 years we've been together now, so this is our greatest hits tour.
Amazing.
But we're booking gigs for 2024. We just booked some gigs for July 2024. So
there you go.
Assuming we come back from Everest, it looks like we're carrying on for a bit longer.
Yeah. Oh, I hope you do come back from Everest, but
thank you so much. It's nice thing to say.
Well, if you are hospitalised, it will probably help this podcast. So
great content.
Oh, Ellie, it's been so nice to catch up and to see you. And yeah, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's always a joy to talk to you. Award-winging novel author, Simon Parkin. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ellie. Take care. Thank you so much to my wonderful guest, Ellie Gibson, familiar to some of you for her work on Eurogamer, the website, the video game website, and then familiar to others of you, I expect, through her streaming efforts on Twitch and YouTube. And then still more of you probably know her best for her work in Scummy Mummies, the comedy duo that she is in with her friend Helen. As you can hear from that tape, I spoke to Ellie just before she head off to her Himalayan gig that she was planning to do as part of Scummy Mummies. I'm pleased to say that they did survive. They did do their gig and they have managed to return. So that's good news, of course. It was only jesting at the end there. About her, this being the last podcast she did. Very thankful, of course, that that was not the case. And so congratulations to them for that work. You can see Scummy Mummies performing all around the country at the Edinburgh Festival. They often play. They do sold out shows everywhere, and it's a raucous, fun time where, from the sounds of things, when you're in the audience, lots and lots of parents have turned up to let their hair down a bit. And get away from the children and the babysitter for a night. So yeah, it's good times. If you have children, or you look after any kids, or you're an uncle or an aunt or anything like that, then yeah, definitely check out Scummy Mummies. They have a very, very popular podcast. They've got books and they've got live shows. So all sorts of ways to follow what Ellie is doing in that sense as well. You can follow me as well on Twitter at Simon Parkin, where I will tweet about my perfect console, but also the journalism that I do and the books that I write and things like that as well, if that's of interest. And you can, of course, follow the podcast itself at My Perfect Console with the O's removed. Each week I will be doing sort of previews of what guests are coming up and also reviews of the choices that previous guests have made as well. So follow that if you're interested. If you would like to financially support the podcast, go to Acast Plus. You can become an early access supporter, and for just £3 a month, not very much, I don't think, less than a magazine, you will get your episodes 24 hours before the general public and ad free. Even if you don't want to do that, but you do have a spare 30 seconds, and I'd really appreciate if you left a rating and a review for the podcast, either on the podcast app or a rating on Spotify or however it is you have found this and are listening to it. It does help other people find the show. Okay, only remains for me to say thank you so much for joining me this week. Thank you to my guest, Ellie, who is just a wonderful person and such fun. And I think that came across in this episode. And I'll be back again next week with one more guest, five games, and another perfect console. Till then, bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.